This is me telling you this. The program is Media Network.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the Media Network Vintage Radio Archive.
Radio Netherlands, not national, but international, broadcasting direct from Northwest Europe. Media Network, the weekly communications magazine with Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello, welcome to the program. Coming up today, a look at digital video broadcasting. Plus shortwave news, of course. But first, a bit of this.
Feedback, in fact. Thanks for the phone calls and faxes as a result of the new transmission period, which started last Sunday. Our Department of Frequency Planning asks me to pass on their thanks. And people are using electronic mail more and more.
Now, there are new ways to contact international broadcasters. As well as the traditional letter, there's phone, fax, and now you can also send electronic mail to our internet address.
So zip your questions and comments to letters at rnw.nl.
And if all this is new to you, why not ask for a copy of Info Dutch, which explains electronic bulletin boards and shares tips about radio-related software. It's all part of Radio Netherlands Public Service, because we're not number one. You are.
I still long for you.
And as usual, all those publications are free of charge.
Now, news from the World Radio TV Handbook editorial office in Amsterdam. Here's Andy Sennett.
Indeed, lots of changes this last weekend, with the change, of course, to wintertime here in Europe. Anything to report?
Yes, with the news from the Voice of Turkey, and their schedule has been completely altered for the new winter period, and there's been a substantial increase in transmitting hours. As far as English is concerned, there are four daily transmissions as follows. At 04-05 hours UTC, to Asia, on 9560 and 9685 kHz, to the Pacific on 9560 kHz, and to Europe and North America on 7190 kHz. At 1330 to 1430, to Europe and Asia on 9445 kHz. At 1930 to 2030, to Europe on 9445 kHz. And at 23 to 24 hours, to Europe on 7190 and 7280 kHz, to North America on 7190 kHz, and to Asia and the Pacific on 9560 kHz.
Well, that increase is in sharp contrast to stations like Radio Finland, who have actually cut back their shortwave quite extensively for the start of the winter period. OK, now to a station from the Pacific.
Yes, we've received the new winter schedule of Transworld Radio Guam, KTWR, which includes the new DX programme produced by Australian Radio DX Club. The programme is called Pacific DX Report, and it's on the air every Saturday at 0815 UTC to the Far East on 15200 kHz, 15200, and 0940 UTC on 11830 kHz to the South Pacific, 11830. The South Asian service carries the program on Mondays at 1615 UTC on 11580 kHz, 11580.
Well, on the 10th of October in the Netherlands, all the telephone numbers change. We've been publicising our new telephone numbers as far as the answer line is concerned. 3135-6724-222. But phone numbers are changing elsewhere.
Yes, everyone seems to be getting in on the act these days. The latest one we've heard about is Iceland. The National Broadcasting Service in Reykjavik has changed its phone and fax numbers. So, if you need to contact them, the phone number is country code 354... then 515-3000, and the fax number is 354-515-3010, and those changes apparently took effect in June of this year.
Quite a few reactions as a result of the tests that Veronica's currently doing on 3095 kHz. More medium wave news?
Yes, there are some new opportunities to log a couple of small European countries on medium wave. The Gibraltar Broadcasting Corporation informs us that it now runs 24 hours a day on 1458 kHz and FM. So that might provide the extra reception during the nighttime hours here in Europe. Look for Radio Gibraltar on 1458 kHz. Another small European country which has increased its transmission time is the Faroe Islands, and transmissions on 531 kHz, 531, are now at 0715 to 20 hours Monday to Friday, 0715 to 01 hours on Saturday, and 10 hours to 19 hours UTC on Sunday.
At this point in the programme, let's bring out the line to Caversham Park in the UK, where Chris Greenway from BBC Monitoring is waiting for some news connected with former Yugoslavia.
That's right. Well, Radio Yugoslavia, the shortwave external service broadcasting out of Belgrade, still continues to broadcast and continues to put out good signals, in fact. Interestingly enough, it's using transmitters in Bosnia, although the station itself is based in the Serbian and Yugoslav capital of Belgrade. Their shortwave transmitters are just across the border in a place called Bjelnjina, which is in eastern Bosnia. And they've remained more or less on the air despite the military activity and the NATO air raids and so forth over the past few weeks. Though they have said that their operations have been somewhat disrupted by those air raids, but they're still on the air. And the director of Radio Yugoslavia has given a rather interesting interview to a Belgrade newspaper. First of all, he gave some history about of the station, pointing out that it's one of the world's longest-running external services. It began broadcasting from what was then the Kingdom of Yugoslavia right back in 1936. And he mentioned that at that time it was being used to counter propaganda being put out by German and Italian stations. Now, coming right up to date, he said a couple of very interesting things, first of which was that, like so many other shortwave broadcasters these days, they're faced with funding problems, which could pose a threat to the whole future of the station. But another thing he said in this interview was that the station was looking at reaching rebroadcast and mutual relay agreements with other broadcasters. And two he mentioned very specifically were China Radio International. This would be a deal whereby both China Radio International and Radio Yugoslavia would relay each other's broadcasts to the particular part of the world where they're based. And also he mentioned that a similar arrangement might be struck with Radio Bulgaria, the external service broadcasting out of Sofia.
Interesting that China Radio International wants to get back in the Balkans, because it used to have a deal with Radio Tirana in Albania.
Oh, well, that's right. That's going back some time now, of course. But yes, those of us with fairly long memories about the shortwave bands will remember that Radio Peking, as it was in those days, used to broadcast from powerful transmitters in Albania. So it's interesting, yes, that this would be somewhat turning the clock back. Of course, more recently, CRI have been rebroadcast via Switzerland.
Andy, you remember the days of Radio Peking, Albania?
Yes, in fact, I was actually working at BBC Monitoring. It was back in the mid-70s.
Right, back to shortwave.
Yes, after many years, All India Radio has finally stopped using the rather odd offset frequency of 7412 kHz and has moved down to 7410. This affects, amongst other things, the transmission in English at 1530 to 1545 UTC and the general overseas service to Western Europe at 1745 to 1945 UTC. And I was delighted to receive that information from an old friend, Alok Dasgupta, who has resumed his shortwave listening activities after some years of illness. Welcome back, Alok.
Andy, there have been some reports on the internet that the WRTH 496 wouldn't be published. Isn't that a confusion connected with the equipment buyer's guide?
I think it must be, Jonathan. Someone called me the other evening at home and said that they'd heard rumours, partly from Germany for some reason. And, yes, the equipment buyer's guide has been delayed due to the fact that we haven't had many new receivers released recently. We will be publishing a second edition just as soon as we're able to do the tests. And as far as WRTH is concerned, it's alive and well, and I'm now busy preparing the 50th anniversary edition.
Finally, to a mystery.
Yes, BBC Monitoring has been asking for the help of DXers in trying to find out the identity of a station they've been hearing in the 20-metre ham band on 14201.5 kHz in upper sideband. And it's not a ham station itself, although it could be a ham relaying a broadcast. It seems to be coming from the Romania-Moldova area. One of the announcers has a Moldovan accent. Apparently the program's in Romanian. It's got military and patriotic music. And that suggests it's probably connected with the current dispute involving the breakaway Russian-speaking area of Dnester. And BBC monitoring have heard the station as early as 0530 UTC and as late as 11 hours UTC, but they do say it's erratic, it goes off suddenly without warning, and some days they don't hear it at all. If anyone has any idea what it might be, Chris Greenway would like to hear from you on this fax number, country code 44 for the United Kingdom, area code 1734, then 461993.
True, not everyone listens to Radio Netherlands.
I came to Casablanca for the waters.
The waters? What waters? We're in the desert.
I was misinformed.
Don't you wish you were better informed? Radio Netherlands, international public radio, direct from Europe.
We'll pick up the old satellite mobile phone now, and on the other end is Lou Josephs, our media man in Boston, who we haven't spoken to for ages. Lou, last time you were on the wireless, you said the medium wave band in North America was being extended at the high frequency part. What's happened?
Funny you should mention that. The first of those brand new expanded radio stations on 1660, WJDM in Elizabeth, New Jersey, was due on the air in the month of October. That's not going to happen, because when the FCC took a look at how they did the allocations for these new expanded band frequencies, they realized they made lots of errors.
But what sort of mistakes did they make then?
Well, Jonathan, if you're in Canada or Mexico and you had a radio station that was assigned to one of those frequencies or had an auxiliary service on one of those frequencies, you might find a brand new 10,000-watt radio station in your backyard.
So interference problems. Also to the Traveler Information Service.
Yeah, those are those little stations that you find near national parks, near airports, and places like Walt Disney World and Disneyland in California that direct you to the parking lot or direct you to an attraction. They found they put several of these stations on top of them, so to speak, within an area where it would cause severe interference.
As far as digital audio broadcasting is concerned, we heard at the conference that the FCC still hasn't made up its mind as far as which system it would like to go for, including which system it might use for AM digital radio. It's doing some tests, but those tests haven't quite yet been completed.
Well, actually, the Electronic Industries Association portion of the tests have been completed, and they've caused quite a controversy, because, believe it or not, the Eureka system turns out to be the better option according to these tests.
On the one hand, the industry wants to sell new technology, but do the broadcasters want to pay for it?
Well, it depends. Some do, some don't. If you're successful now and you're looking towards the future, you're looking towards all kinds of things to improve your product. So you're going to spend more money on the technology. I mean, talk radio stations, which you mainly find on AM, are spending fortunes on improving the sound of their telephone calls and making it easier to identify frequent callers.
What about the Internet? I mean, we've seen the launch now of Windows 95, which also has a package to make access to the Internet much easier. Is that having any effect on the media?
Well, first, we haven't had that much of a big impact from the launch of Windows 95 on the Internet yet, because there are problems inherent with the Microsoft browser. It's mainly very, very slow using the Microsoft network. So that's problem number one. So all the anticipated people that people expected to magically show up on the Internet haven't yet. Problem number two is that once you get up on the net, it hasn't been really pointed out from the broadcasters, particularly the commercial broadcasters, where to find their sites. And this is very true of both ABC and NPR and CBS, who are now providing hourly newscasts on the net. The same is also true of CNN. If it wasn't for the fact that I judiciously read trades, I would have never known that CNN had a website up.
Do you think Real Audio is going to make an impact or something like it?
Well, it's a toss-up between the two systems, Real Audio and also Zing Technologies' digital streaming technology. Digital streaming appears to offer a better alternative for broadcasters because it'll almost give you stereo quality.
But, again, the consumer still has to phone in and basically pay for radio, whereas normally they can get it off the air for free.
Yeah, that's true. And I think the biggest problem inherent in the rush to the Internet is what you're going to use it for, and effectively, is it an adjunct to your over-the-air signal, or are you trying to use it just because it's cool?
And if you're using it for the latter, in other words, it's just cool, it's not going to last very long.
Yeah, I mean, once the novelty wears off, I'll give you an example. If you trot over to the CBS television webpage, you'll find that they're still advertising the fact that David Letterman is going to London. Well, that happened in May.
Ah, I remember that music. Not my style, I can assure you, but the words fit, because there is TV news. We've had a few questions about DVB as a result of the Berlin Radio Fair and the recent International Broadcasting Convention in Amsterdam. Peter McAvoch is with the DVB Project Office, organised by the European Broadcasting Union in Geneva, Switzerland. Simple question then, what's the difference between digital audio broadcasting, DAB, and DVB?
DVB, the Digital Video Broadcasting Project, is an organisation of now about 185 members, which was founded in September of 1993 by a group of consumer electronics manufacturers, broadcasters and regulatory bodies to promote the idea of digital television in Europe. The project itself was originally a European platform, and has remained an essentially European platform, but has now, because of our idea to promote an open set of standards for digital television, has now become a viable worldwide alternative to existing services.
So what's the drive to switch from analogue to digital? I mean, there are Astro satellites up at the moment, there are Eutelsat Hotbirds, all of them broadcasting a lot of channels. What's the problem?
The major drive is coming from the service providers who have seized on digital television to do one of two things for them. The first thing would be to enable them to more efficiently utilise the capacity that they have. For example, on an Astra transponder, we are demonstrating a system where there are four television channels all being transmitted in a transponder that would originally only take one analog channel. The second thing would be the enormous increase in the flexibility of the service he would be able to provide. So he might decide as a broadcaster that his audience would prefer a higher quality television than what exists at the moment. That is possible. Would prefer a wider range of television programs, perhaps special interest programs, but not particularly at high quality. He would be able to, with his capacity, to configure that to transmit a large number of lower quality channels. And the DVB project itself is now examining the whole area of interactive television, which would enable them, the broadcaster, the provider, to establish all kinds of interactive services, which up till now haven't existed.
Is it also being driven by the problems of pirating as far as coding are concerned? Because presumably, if you look at the complexity of digital systems, the hobbyists are not going to sit at home with a soldering iron trying to decode subscription channels.
There is no doubt about the fact that the digital box itself, in terms of its complexity, is far more complex than existing analog boxes, and indeed probably far more complex than some personal computers. In terms of the scrambling and the conditional access area, the DVB project has defined a scrambling algorithm which has proved to be very secure. There is obviously a drive from the point of view of broadcasters to tighten up, if you like, the whole area of scrambling and conditional access. And these new digital techniques provide them with just the series of tools and flexibilities that they would need.
Will the picture be better? I say that because wandering around the exhibition, you see some indeed compromised systems or compressed systems where you say, well, once the picture suddenly moves very fast, I see blocks on the screen and I didn't see that with my old VHS tape recorder.
It is true to say that television in general has always been a compromise between how much the consumer is willing to pay for getting the pictures and how good we can actually make the pictures. From the point of view of the DVB project, We will not promise that better pictures are available, but we can certainly say that our system provides the flexibility far more so than it exists at the moment, so that if you as a broadcaster decided to get much better quality pictures, we can certainly do that. From the point of view of high definition television, I think that there is no doubt but that it will be the future of television. The question is when. There's the whole area of receivers and when the viable wall-mounted receiver will come in and all this.
Radio Netherlands Consumer Investigation.
I want my money back.
We dig deeper.
But isn't there a danger that what you buy today will be obsolete tomorrow? In Germany, quite a few thousand people invested well over $1,000 to buy the digital satellite receiver DSR. They were promised digital quality radio in the living room via the Copernicus satellite. Now it's been decided to discontinue the idea next year. So tough luck if you have this type of radio, although some collectors may want one for their shelves. At the same time, Astra digital radio receivers have been launched in Germany and shortly will be available in the UK for around $500. Some of the channels will be free, but most are coded, and you have to pay a subscription to the programmer BMX if you want the continuous music services. Isn't there a danger that the same obsolescence problem will raise its head in digital video broadcasting? Peter McEvoch again.
The DVB system itself is viewed as being one of the major applications of MPEG. MPEG, which will be the core element in our system, has proven to be, over quite an extended period of time, as being a very, very viable means of playing this compromise of quality versus the price. At the moment, MPEG is now being adapted, if you like, to the professional environment, so it seems likely that very shortly we will have a whole MPEG chain right from the studio to the home. And this could go even via the likes of CD-ROM and everything, which at the moment are being encoded in MPEG-1, but could conceivably be encoded in MPEG-2.
What's the difference? Is one better than the other?
MPEG is a layered system, and all MPEG-2 equipment will decode MPEG-1.
But MPEG-1 is an inferior picture to an MPEG-2 picture?
The theory behind MPEG originally was to develop coding systems which would be used for the very low bitrate applications, as would be found in video on small postage stamp-like size screens on your personal computer. MPEG-2 has extended that realm to the area of full-resolution television. They were aimed at different areas, and MPEG has ensured that both are interworkable, if you like. We have tried in some of our documentation to explain a little bit how it all operates, but essentially it is very difficult to explain to the user that something that he sees at home can actually be made so that he can see it at home at much less cost to the broadcaster. To explain how it works, it's a little bit like trying to explain what the CD did to the old LP, only we're squeezing the information into a smaller place.
Is the technique then also a bit that rather than sending all the pictures, you're only sending the changes in the pictures, is that fair?
It would be fair to say that with new digital techniques and the digitization of pictures, we are able to send just changes in pictures rather than in complete pictures.
Is there an idea of a watershed and also a price that people will have to pay?
Some commentators have likened the advent of digital television to being as important, if not more important, than the advent of colour. It is clear that the digital receivers will start off more expensive than existing analogue receivers, but we're talking in the millions of receivers even at this stage. So it seems likely that the economies of scale will come into play quite quickly, reducing the cost of the receivers over a period of time. Exactly how much the receiver will cost for the consumer will depend on exactly how the broadcasters want to configure the system. Do they need a good quality receiver? A whole series of options will determine the eventual price of the receiver.
And when will we actually see services actually starting up?
We have no official announcement dates because of the fact that it is also new and also moving so quickly. It seems likely that services will start in and around the end of this year.
I can't wait to review one.
Radio Netherlands. We're sort of MTV without all that music, commercials, and those annoying videos.
Back to shortwave for a few minutes now. Good old radio. And an email from David Forrester, who lives in Vancouver, Canada, who says he listens regularly to the show, but is curious how we all got started in shortwave. Well, I confess I got into broadcasting through the listening side 21 years ago now, listening originally to Austrian Radio's shortwave service, now Radio Austria International. I also put David's question to Victor Gunatilaka, our man in Sri Lanka, and discovered his interest was because of sports.
Well, it was listening to cricket commentaries and later on, of course, the great interest in international affairs, current affairs. So to get more information about cricket scores and also keep in touch with what was happening in the world, I used to listen to shortwave and at the age of 12.
And you still do?
Oh, yes, I think I will be a shortwave listener to the last days of my life.
And what do you do in normal life? Because you do technical monitoring for a number of radio stations, but also you teach?
Yes, I teach. In fact, on the 15th of September this year, I finished 26 years of teaching. And Jonathan, I must say that everything that I have gathered from shortwave goes straight into my teaching career. Every morning, my staff mates in school would ask me what I have heard on the radio. So I always like to make this point that it's not only the person who tunes a radio or the unseen audience that some radio stations like to tabulate according to the reception reports they get. Maybe a listener in an African village having one radio, shortwave radio, could inform 15,000 people.
Got an interesting letter here from Thomas Lendon, who writes from the Republic of South Africa, but says he actually is stationed 80 kilometres south of Kayes, a town on the Senegal River in the western part of Mali. Sounds very exotic. He's using a Sony ICF-2001D, but he reports hearing the BBC at 21 hours UTC on 123.525 megahertz, in other words, on the airband of the set. Sounds like something's wrong with that receiver.
Well, Jonathan, yes, certainly, because you won't hear the BBC on the airband. Probably the Sony ICF 2010 is quite famous for lightning strikes, and if you are exposed to heavy static, the front end can get damaged, and that increases cross-modulation. I had the same problem some years ago when I used the 2010 before it really got a big lightning flash and disappeared completely.
So either receiver is damaged, or maybe the receiver is simply being overloaded. Thomas says in his letter that he's using a long wire antenna. Doesn't say quite how long, and maybe at that time of night signals are strong enough to break through, I guess.
Yes, definitely, especially in the tropics or in the third world, we have space and we go for long antennas, and cross-modulation is quite a common thing. Definitely, of course, it has to be something within the receiver.
Talking about receivers, what do you actually operate at the moment?
Well, I use a communication receiver for my DXing, an ICOM R70, and for casual shortwave listening or my monitoring, I use a Roberts R809 and two shortwave band domestic set, because I like to know what the general listener, what reception he gets.
And what sort of antenna?
Well, a series of long antennas, very good antennas, ham band antennas, but for my average listener type of reception, just use a little bit of long wire, about 18 feet of wire just outside the window. I get Radio Netherlands very well on that.
Glad to hear it. Victor, a bit of news, though. We noted last week that Deutsche Welle's relay station in the northeast part of Sri Lanka is off the air at the moment because of the unstable situation there. There have also been conflicting reports about the Voice of America's new relay station in the west side of the country.
Actually, all reports are correct. VOA has new Marconi transmitters, and also three transmitters from Bethany have arrived already in the station, and these are transmitters from the former Bethany VOA relay station. There are three of them, and VOA is quite optimistic of providing an excellent signal into the Indian subcontinent, East Africa and the Middle East, and also Southeast Asia.
Well, starting when?
Well, target days are a little difficult to predict, but all going well, they hope to be on the air around summer, latest, of course, by about September next year.
What will happen then to the old site at a place called Ekele, north of Colombo?
Well, the SLBC is quite worried about the VOA closing down from Ekele. The SLBC will get the transmitters free of charge, but it will also mean that the VOA will not hire the SLBC transmitters anymore. And more or less, the SLBC has been subsidizing its shortwave service, especially the external service, with the money they got from the VOA. So at the moment, the SLBC's external service seems to be not in very good shape.
Victor, thanks for that news and also for being our guest today. Have a safe trip back to Sri Lanka. And that's all for this edition of Media Network. Join us again in 7 days. In the meantime, from all of us, have a pleasant weekend.
Media Network, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks and Diana Janssen for Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.